Hello, and welcome to Hanks for the Memories. You've got a friend in us. This is episode 9, Volunteers, from 1985. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and with us to talk about this very strange movie that grew on me, and then whatever the opposite of grew on me is, as time went on.
It fell off of you?
It fell off me. It grew on me, then fell off of me. With us, I think he's making his Hanks for the Memories debut. He was on a cruise club, so he's been part of the Tom Tom Club before. He's been on another podcast here on the network. But we have today, from Numlock News, Mr. Walt Hickey. Hello, Walt.
Hello. How's it going, y'all?
Glad to have you here to talk about Volunteers, a movie that is set in 1962, which I realized halfway through. Like, this movie opens with a JFK speech, and I was like, all right, bold choice.
Well, but then there's like a TV montage of 1962, so like, and I don't know, I knew it was the 60s. I couldn't pinpoint the year until John Candy said it, I think. But yeah,
I know, because I figured it was probably back in the day, but also I didn't know. And then he's like, what do you expect, it's 1962 or something like that. I was just like, oh, okay.
It's always helpful when a movie does that.
Yeah, it's again like Americans going to Southeast Asia. You want to be 150% sure of when this is going down, because the messages can be a little bit different. But yeah, I thought it was great.
So the funniest thing about this movie, before we get into whether we liked it or didn't like it and all that sort of fun stuff, was that this guy who was the head of the Peace Corps read the script for this movie and was like, this is terrible. He said, actually, hold on, I want to get the exact quote because it's wonderful. He said, it's like spitting on the American flag.
Whoa.
Who said that? Which head of the Peace Corps?
It was former Peace Corps director Robert Sergeant Sarge Shriver Jr.
Wait, so that's Sergeant Shriver. That's like, he's married into the Kennedys. That's Maria Shriver's father, I think, right?
Oh, okay.
Oh, that makes sense.
So he wanted three things changed. He wanted, instead of Thailand, he wanted to be Burma, because the Peace Corps has never been to Burma, and I guess they could be like, well, this never happened, whatever. Number two, don't say CIA and the Peace Corps in the same breath. And Whoa. Then number three, don't call the Peace Corps. And the movie was like, cool, we're doing none of those things. Release the movie as it was, and then the Peace Corps said, all right, and they still endorsed it. Like, what? I don't understand. It's bananas. They're just like, none of this can happen. This is all going to make us look terrible. And then they did it anyway. They're like, yeah, here, you know, join the Peace Corps.
Reagan, man.
Yeah, I guess they'll take whatever they can get at the end of the day, right? Like a 90-minute commercial for the Peace Corps, whatever.
It is interesting. I don't know what to make of this movie. I guess, Walt, let's start here. Did you like this movie?
I enjoyed portions of it and detested other portions of it.
Okay.
Again, like, I really love different parts of it. I really, like, I think that, again, like, as every movie in the 80s can attest, some stuff just doesn't hold up that well ever anymore. I would say, in general, I was very glad that I watched it. This feels like a very important movie for a lot of people.
Most importantly, it's the one that Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson fell in love making.
I'm extremely specifically referring to that, yeah.
I mean, they had met before on an episode of Bosom Buddies, but I think they both were dating other people at the time. Here, they meet again, they rekindle that romance, and then they get married, I think, a couple years later. So, this is a very important film in the scope of Hanks for the Memories, even though I think ultimately at the end of the day, Mike, we're not going to really remember this movie as anything other than that movie with Rita Wilson.
I used to watch this movie as like a kid. It was on a lot when I was a little kid.
Really?
Yeah, you know, like 1985, like I remember seeing this on HBO like when I was younger, and you know, it was just in the mix with all the other Hanks movies. It was just sort of general viewing in our home. We would rent Tom Hanks films and stuff. So I remember I had seen this before. I remember I loved John Candy, because I always loved John Candy, and I still think he's pretty good in this. And this is Hanks and Candy again for the second time since Splash. But watching it again this time, man, wow. Like, with the, you know, as an adult, having not really paid attention to it in a long time, like, there's a couple moments, but overall, like, I just was not feeling it.
I mean, you gave it a pretty harsh score on Letterboxd, which I don't think is undeserved, because it's not like this movie is great. There's one specific thing in this movie that I adore. When Hanks and his buddy, who plays Long, we'll just call him Long Duk Dong because he's from 16 Candles, when the two of them read the subtitle from the screen, mm-hmm. I fell in love with this movie. Like, I don't like the movie outside of that scene that much, but that was my favorite thing.
See, there was a moment like that very early on, very Johnny Dangerously, very sort of top secret, where they show Hanks being chased down the map in the opening when he's racing to the airport, and then his car, like, drives through the map on the screen. And I was like, holy shit, if we're gonna get more of that, I'm in. But the only other instance of that I could account for was reading the subtitles. Like, it didn't become that parody film.
Right.
I've said, like, I have mixed feelings about it. I'm going to say some unreservedly positive things about this film over the course of the episode. And I just wanted to, like, caveat that beforehand. But, like, there's some really good shit in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really fond of, like, some of the movies that it's making fun of to an extent, like Bridge on the River Kwai. And I think that, like, it's got a lot of interesting stuff going on in there. And whether it coalesces into an actual film kind of remains to be seen. But so many of the individual nuggets from it are very top tier.
You know, Hanks is doing a weird sort of kind of Humphrey Bogart-ish voice. And I only call it that because that's what we would call it if Nicolas Cage was doing that voice.
Hanks is doing an SNL character. Let's not be generous about this.
Joey, he's a total Gatsby, which goes
he
way back.
He is a Gatsby.
Cage Club, yeah.
According to IMDb, it's modeled after two things. That the writer said a young Bob Hope for his false bravado and style, and he said he did it after George Plimpton, who plays his father in this movie.
Who I love.
So he was modeling after his character's father, or the actor who plays his character. Like, it's just this complicated, like, just, you could just say that you're doing a weird old-timey voice.
But also, it's like that classic snobbish voice, right? Like, Muffy, like, come on over by the pool, like, whenever you're ready. Mm-hmm. Like, that kind of thing. Like, you get a lot, so.
Yeah. Well, when we sent you the sign-up sheet for Hanks and Cruz, you essentially said, I will do any movie except Rain Man.
Oh, yeah. I just don't like Rain Man.
So the question is, did you pick this movie or did we pick this one for you?
I selected movies that I had not seen or that I liked, but like I very much enjoy coming on your family of podcasts to talk about movies that are kind of my first experience doing. So like I had been on High School Slumber Party and I talked about Christine. And like I was on the Cruise podcast, which was terrific, talking about, again, a movie that I had not seen, Risky Business, that is just like, again, like that's a chunk of America that most people who talk or like movies at least know about, that kind of stuff. And so with Hanks, I came in with a very open head just by virtue of the fact that I have not actually, like, there's some stuff in his back catalog that I haven't seen, but I've seen a lot of Hanks. And so this was a total delight because I'm really fond of John Candy. And this movie is so weird and also so, it is relevant, which we'll talk about later. But, like, I just thought it was great that I kind of got dealt this card just because this era is a fascinating one for me in film.
Well, what's weird about early Hanks is that, you know, the reason that Mike and I, and we've talked about this on pretty much every episode, I think, in our sort of growing, not frustration with early Hanks, but
maybe disappointment? I don't know.
Maybe a little bit. But we chose Tom Hanks because we knew that there's like a decade of his movies that are like unimpeachably great. Like, you know, from 93-ish to 2004-ish or somewhere in there, in that ballpark, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that. But he just makes hit after hit. And even if you don't like the movie, they're like the biggest movies of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had remembered the ones I had seen as a kid liking a lot, which revisiting hasn't always been the case either, so.
And so we are now 9 episodes in here, 6 movies. This is my second favorite behind Splash, and if, like, either of them end up anywhere near my top of my favorite Hanks movies, like, I will be stunned. They're not bad, but they're just fine. And, like, I think the one thing that we're running into a problem with on these movies, and this movie included, is that what was acceptable and funny in the 80s with 2019 glasses is a little bit troubling. Like, there's just a real lot of racism in this movie.
There's way too much racism for this to be, like, a great movie anymore, you know?
Yeah. Yes. And, like, how do I know you're lying to an Asian character? Your eyes are becoming more round. And it's like, well, that's, I guess that's a clever joke. I mean, it's a terribly racist joke, but, like, at least I haven't heard that a million times before. But also, you would never make that kind of joke today. Like, it's just little things like that that keep happening. It's like, oh, boy. Like, I know this is 24 years ago or 34 years ago, but whew.
Just extreme stereotypes. Yeah, no, like, all the racial humor in this sort of tanked it for me, I guess. And that's something that I just, you know, didn't remember, you know, as a youth. I guess I just wasn't picking up on it. Or like you said, Joey, it was the 80s.
Yeah. Okay, so Walt, let us say some good things about this movie before we get into the bad things about this movie. If you had a favorite moment or scene or line or joke, what was it about Volunteers that you really are going to maybe remember? Like, what was your favorite part of Volunteers?
There was a lot of, like, very good script ideas in this. So, for instance, like, John Candy's character is kind of on the plane, is just kind of shown to be, like, a motivational guy who's really into how, you know, to talk to people and communicate with people and that classic American salesman horseshit. Like, he reads a book and he understands how to get inside the mind of his fellow man. And then he goes over, and his kind of plot is that there's a number of people who are contending, who want this bridge built for various different reasons. We'll get into the rest of them, I'm sure, in a bit. But Candy falls in with effectively the, like, communist group that's operating in the wilderness who would like to use this bridge to help collectivize the entire countryside. And, like, he's just like, I'll never talk. And then, like, cut two, he's immediately turned into a card-carrying enemy of the American running dogs who are operating within the, like, it's just, like, how easily the flip switch turns, and it's just, like, I think it's, like, a pretty elegant satire of, like, oh, yeah, no, this type of guy just exists in a lot of different places in a lot of different ways. And so, like, that scene where he basically joins communism on a dime is one of my favorite things in this, just because it's, like, I've seen this happen on Twitter.
But Twitter is such a healthy place for everybody. How could this happen on Twitter?
So I would say that, like, that's the kind of sensibility that I actually really enjoyed out of this.
What I like in a related way to that, and it's something that I've seen a lot, but it still made me laugh in here, is when John, the leader, you know, the CIA guy, who we don't know is CIA until like maybe two-thirds of the way through the movie or whatever, and he's talking to Rita Wilson, and Rita Wilson's like, I can't believe, you know, this Tom Hanks guy, he's such a waste, you know, all this different stuff, right? Like, he just can't do anything, he's not trying, he's just goofing around. And they look down, and he's, like, giving this motivational speech to the townspeople, like, we're gonna build a bridge, and it's gonna be a great bridge. And, like, it just made me crack up, because it's, like, again, similar to the John Candy turning on a dime, it's like Tom Hanks turning on a dime because this is his ticket out of there, right? Like, this is how he's gonna get that $48,000 in that plane ticket back to America and pay off the mob boss that he owes money or whatever. But I just love that sort of, it's expected, but it's also that subversion of expectations where it's this Tom Hanks character who shows up and is just doing magic tricks and playing cards with these guys. And then once he has a reason to get out of there or to do something, to do some work, he puts to work his skills. And I'm also glad in a related way that he's not just like this rich kid that isn't good at anything. Like, I like that he is able to do things. You know what I mean, Mike? Like, he has skills and traits and charisma and the ability to learn languages and all this different stuff, that he's not just some rich kid who, like, is totally in over his head. He's driven and able to, you know, improve upon a situation.
Yeah, I mean, he has got a Yale education, right? Like, he's no slouch, really. Like, he's just...
Shout out Joe, too.
He's just not motivated. Like, he just doesn't want to apply himself. And, you know, his dad was ultimately right. He, you know, forced him into a situation in which he's got to rely on his skills and stuff. And, you know, I doubt he thought he would find all that in the middle of the jungle or anything, but there are a lot of good parts of this movie. Like, I really love the part when John Candy is just first wandering through the jungle and he meets a tiger. Like, I could just watch John Candy and a tiger and him reacting to that for like 40 minutes. And I also love, I think maybe my favorite part throughout the movie is when the one villager who can speak English keeps referring to Tom Hanks as asshole or dickhead or just like, you know, he never really calls him by his name, but he's just like, yo, asshole. I don't know, I was really laughing at those moments, so.
Mike, was one of those your favorite moment, or what was your favorite moment in the movie?
Probably Tom Hanks' character being referred to as dickhead most of the movie by that guy. And just everything, I guess, John Candy was doing in general. Missed that guy, wish he, you know, had made a couple more flicks, but what we got is pretty good. Like, he's never the problem in any of these old movies.
Yeah, and like, I feel like his kind of character in this movie could very easily be overused and become annoying, but he's not overused. You know what I mean? He's in it enough that we would know who he is and what he's doing. We see that sort of, you know, like, well, like Walt was saying before, that growth and that change, but he's not the annoying stereotype that he otherwise could be if he's in this movie for another 20 minutes or half an hour. So I appreciated that. I'm gonna say my favorite moment is the reading of the subtitles, but I also like at the end that just from off screen, like, a monkey jumps into Rita Wilson's arms and spends the rest of the movie just holding the monkey.
Yes.
Like, I don't know where the monkey... I rewound it because I was like, did that monkey... And just like, the monkey jumps from off screen into her arms and then she just holds it. And I was like, oh, just chilling with the monkey as Hanks is blowing up the bridge. Like, I love that. Like, I don't know why that happens at all, but I love it.
No, but the thing is, like, that monkey extremely obviously did not jump. It was very obviously, like, tossed by the key grip into her hands, which is my favorite part of that.
Now, Walt, on the other side of the coin, let's curb racism. Like, that's a weird way of saying.
Let's table the obvious racism that makes us all unhappy about this movie.
Yes, because that is, without a doubt, I think, all of our least favorite part of the movie. But aside from that, is there something about here that, like, doesn't, I mean, not that it's a perfect movie, but, like, what's your least favorite part? What don't you like about Volunteers?
Yeah, totally. I think that, just to kind of give a bird's eye view of the plot, like, these guys were sent here by the Peace Corps to build a bridge over a dedicated, like, a very important strategic point. There are three people interested in this bridge. One is the aforementioned communists. One is the local CIA branch who wants to roll out to beat up those aforementioned communists. And the third group is this like, again, like, drug den, like, this drug empire, so to speak, right? And the drug lord doesn't work for me as well. I can totally see why that character existed. Like, a couple years before this movie, you had, like, the Deer Hunter, right? And so you can, like, there's absolutely like this trope that exists of just like, ah, yes, the opium dealer. And the idea is that this character, and it's not even the character because we can set aside the, we agreed to set aside some stuff. The plotline doesn't work for me as well or as elegantly as the CIA one and the communist one. And I don't like the weird kidnapping thing that happens with the CIA. Like that plot kind of starts to fall apart towards the end of the movie. And that was just like, that's kind of like a tactical gripe, but I felt like a lot of the different components of that part, like the assassin totally didn't work for me. Like even I get like going for the weird, like Bond-esque assassin with a gimmick thing. It just, that didn't necessarily do it for me. Like some of the other parts did.
It's not like there's too much going on in this movie. It's just, it almost at times feels like there's too much going on. Like maybe if they had cut one of those things, they could have made the other two better. That, not that everything doesn't work well, but because you have sort of three main thrusts as you were describing, there's just a lot to sort of keep track of and, you know, make each memorable in a way that make them stand out from the rest in a certain way. Like, oh, this is the John Candy part, or this is the CIA part, or this is the, you know, assassin with long nails. And it's a lot of balls to keep in the air, which is unfortunate use a phrase to use, Mike, because there's no juggling in this movie.
It's a very long movie, too, I will say, like, on that point. Like,
yeah, this should have been, like, a 90-minute movie.
Yes, and it's, like, 20 minutes longer than that. Yeah. And I think that, like, there's a lot going on here.
I took a break 50 minutes in to get dinner, and I was like, oh, I've only got like half an hour left. And I was like, oh no, I have an hour left. Like, I have so much more of this movie. And, you know, I think my favorite chunk, and not sort of specific reasons, but I think my favorite part of this movie kind of is the middle. Like, I think there's fun in the opening, and I think there's enjoyment to be had there, but I think the movie really gets going once Hanks gets going, once his character starts building that bridge, and I really like that part there. So I don't think it lags in the middle, it's just that there's just a lot. Like, it just, there's a lot of plot here, and I don't know that there necessarily needs to be.
It felt to me like it was spending a lot of time on stuff. Like, it's not necessarily that there was like a whole lot of stuff going on, but it's like the opening card scene goes on forever. Like the casino scene in the middle goes on forever. Like the date with Rita Wilson kind of goes, you know, like it just feels like the interrogation with the drug lord, like it just goes on and on and on. Like, at least that's how it felt.
Like the kidnapping didn't need to, like that could have been lickety split. Like that didn't have to be as expensive as a set piece as it was.
Yeah. And I think back to like how funny and how quick and the timing of how John Candy is turned, right? And it's all done in a cut. Like, 1 minute you see him, like, I'm never going to surrender. And then, like, cut, and he's like, whatever you want, whatever you say.
We must drive the capitalist running dogs from the countryside. Like, it's great. It's so good. The People's Army.
Like, all that stuff. Like, so the pacing, I think, might be my least favorite part of the movie, Joey, is just, like, they knew that they could shorten. It seemed like they knew they could shorten it. Like, there was the opportunity to create maybe more jokes out of the momentum of the film, you know, and instead it just kind of felt like it got stuck in quicksand every once in a while, you know, and started to drag here and there, and it was just maybe that on top of everything was disengaging me at moments from the stuff, where I was just like, come on, like, I get it, like, he loves to play cards. Like, what other kind of illicit things does he do, though? Not many, you know, he's just really into gambling, but it could have been funny if he was like brewing his own liquor or other kinds of stuff, but so I think I'll go with that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I don't know, aside from like racism aside, I'm trying to think of it, like, there's not a lot about this movie that really stands out as something that I don't love. Not that I love it, but it's just sort of, it's all fine. I think what you guys both said are both really good examples of, you know, ways that we could improve this, ways that, you know, it could be better and quicker and breezier watch. So I don't have anything really constructive to add here. I do have a question though. His last name is Bourne. Is this a prequel to The Bourne Identity? Spelled the same way.
He does have some experience working with the CIA in a tight role, so I don't know.
Because obviously in the first Bourne movie, Bourne Identity, Matt Damon wakes up without a memory, and he is sort of like a kind of a James Bondy kind of spy-ish. And Hanks in that smoking jacket or the dinner jacket that he's wearing kind of looks like Bond. Maybe this is the same character. Who knows? Or is his dad or something.
Or what I'm thinking is, like, this, the CIA, like, they took this persona and, like, identity and put it in a file so that one day it could be, you know, a covert sort of alias for one of their agents in the field.
That's definitely what happened.
Like, Lawrence Bourne III could be the father of Jason Bourne I, and I like the CIA guys love recruiting from the Waspies, you know? They were on the Mayflower, and they're not going to flip to the Russians, you know?
Exactly. The first of his name, Jason of the Bournes. I do like how this movie, I don't say that I like it, I just think it's a weird choice that sort of tickled me a little bit. The way the movie ends is that Tom Hanks writes a letter to his dad, and he's just like, I'm going to become a drug lord here. Oops, Did I say drugs? I mean, I'm just going to run this town. And it's like, oh, it feels like they didn't know how to end the movie. Like, the bridge explodes. He falls in love with Rita Wilson. How do we give a happy ending? Oh, he can just write a letter to his dad. But it never maybe this is my least favorite thing. It never feels like there's any relation, true relation, to who he was before he went down there. That, like, we spend a fair amount of time at Yale, where he's gambling, where he's playing poker, where he's with Bootsy, where it's him and his roommate, and him at graduation, him at commencement, whatever. There's a lot of time there for, like, that to mean absolutely nothing. All it means is that he needs to find a way to get money to pay this mob boss off. Although, it feels like the guy's not going to come to Thailand for $24,000. Feels like he's safe. Like, it just feels like there's, like, I like that there's a little bit of a bow put on the end there that, like, hey, like, we're gonna wrap things up by saying I'm never gonna go back to my life. But at the same time, it sort of feels like that was unnecessary in terms of the story.
I completely disagree with you here, because this is my favorite thing about this movie.
Oh, okay.
I love how it's like some of that, like, early Seinfeld shit where it's just like, nobody learns lessons, nobody gets better, we're the same crappy people at the beginning of the episode as we are at the end of the episode, there's no hugging. What I love about it is that this movie was, like, written by the moderators of the neoliberal subreddit. Like, it's just, it's perfect. Like, this guy comes in, learns nothing, and decides to do the exact, like, he wants to run a gambling house in another country. It's like, it knows its character so well, because, like, this Yale schmuck wouldn't grow over the course of this experience.
True,
he would just
true.
Kind of see a new angle. Like, the idea is that, like, he's not presented as a, like, what did he learn? Well, there's no lesson to learn over the course of the movie. He didn't, like, try and fail and, like, learn a valuable thing about the values of perseverance. He just, like, got by and then increasingly found that, oh no, I just gotta work for myself, because the other three people who want me to do this stuff are not going to back me. And so he just, like, tripled down on himself and then, like, recruited these other Peace Corps people to do it and just opened a bar. I just love the fidelity to the characters, that they didn't feel the need to, like, make him learn a lesson, because that exact type of dude would not.
It's kind of sitcom-y in that way, right? And I guess, you know, Hanks has a lot of history with sitcoms in that, like, for the most part, characters start the episode and end the episode in the same place, because if you have growth, I mean, there are shows that have growth, like, you know, BoJack or whatever, but I feel like for the most part, like, there's through lines, but the characters are pretty much the same at the beginning as they are at the end. And in that way, this is sort of like that. Like, they have a lot of wacky misadventures and then wind up exactly where they started, with just like a, there could almost be a Volunteers too, where it's, now I'm running this, and then he has to, like, that all falls apart, he has to go to a different country and does the same thing or whatever. So I agree, I think those are all very good points, Walt. I like that you put that into context for me, or that gave me reason to enjoy that, because I like how goofy the ending feels, and I now appreciate the perspective of this guy would never learn anything. So I do like that.
And again, I think that might be a shout out. This movie was very inspired by Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia, if not inspired by them. Like, rich boy goes to other country and then makes them, like, tries to put his mark on there and that kind of stuff, down to the blowing up a bridge in order to prevent a larger scale conflict kind of thing, right? And, like, those movies end with, like, the characters growing and changing and being influenced by the people. But, like, this dumb idiot doesn't learn jack. Like, he just learns that other people can cheat at poker too.
There's one scene in particular here that people had problems with, not racism problems with, but problems with when the movie came out. Can either of you pinpoint what scene people might have been like, it feels a little weird?
This movie feels a little weird.
That's very true. Good point. The scene I'm referring to is Volunteers, brought to you by Coca-Cola.
Oh, yeah.
That there's that scene. So there's the top trivia on IMDb. This is a long thing, so let me read this. So there was mild controversy. So basically, maybe, like, there was one article written about it or something.
Someone at Pepsi got mad.
So TriStar made this movie, which is a division of Columbia, which was owned at the time by Coca-Cola. And so apparently they were releasing around this time, like, VHS copies of, like, Ghostbusters with an advertisement for Coke on the actual tape. So, like, Coke was everywhere at this time. Not that Coke has really gone away, but Coke was really everywhere at this time. And so the screenwriter, Ken Levine, wrote into the story that she wanted to get a Coke, and then it stayed through every version, wound up on the screen. No one at TriStar, no one at Columbia, no one at Coca-Cola asked them to do it. But then once it came out, people were like, wait a minute, why is this, because is this the only reason this movie got made, because of Coca-Cola or whatever? Because in the movie, it's like, oh, I sure could use a Coke. I'm going to stay for that Coke. I want original Coke. This tastes so good. Coca-Cola.
It's the most, it's like what reminds her of America. She goes, oh, yeah. Like, it tastes like America or something.
And he says the perfect little button on this quote from the screenwriter says, it just would have been so much easier if we just offered her a joint. Instead of like a Coke, just like, hey, you want to smoke a little weed? And she's like, oh, I'll stay for that. But instead, you know, just, I want that sweet, sweet Coca-Cola. And it feels like a commercial in the middle of the movie, but it's not, apparently. It's just a joke.
It plays better knowing that it was a joke, you know, and that's more, I guess, of the comedy I was expecting, you know, and maybe that's why I didn't buy it. That's why it felt like a commercial to me, because there wasn't as much of that as I was expecting throughout the movie. Like, it was just, you know, it was more straight than that for the most part. But now I think that's fucking hilarious. At the time, I was like, this is crazy. But I love it now. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie after that story.
Oh, it was nice to see George Plimpton in a movie. I like that guy a lot.
What would I know him from? I know that he's famous. Like, I know the name, but I don't know, yeah. Like, what has he been in? Or what would I know him from?
He's not, like, an actor. I mean, I'm sure that he's been in other stuff. George Plimpton was a writer. His shtick, and, like, again, like, I have an enormous amount of fondness for this, was, like, he went out and did stuff. Like, he did a round of boxing with Sugar Ray, and, like, he's a journalist who did the experiential journalism kind of thing.
Kind of like Hunter S. Thompson-y?
Yes. I mean, like, again, I believe that they were, if not colleagues at times, then, like, they were aware of each other. But, like, he was even more so than Hunter S. Thompson. Like, he tried out for the NFL as a kicker kind of thing. And, like, he did bullfighting. Like, he was the guy who did a thing and then would write the article about, here's what it feels like to do this thing, and, like, learn by doing. It wasn't so much Gonzo, where, like, you would experience the Kentucky Derby by going to the Kentucky Derby. Plimpton was very much like, you experience the Kentucky Derby by, like, riding a horse to the Kentucky Derby. And so he's, like, as a journalist, like, he's great. Like, he has a lot of fascinating thing about him. And, like, he was just one of those, like, ultra patrician types. Like, again, he spoke like he speaks in the movie, and he is this waspy fellow, which I imagine is why he kind of got recruited into the role. But, like, I'm trying to think if there's, like, other stuff that he has been in that you would, like, recognize. He's probably cameoed in a ton of shit, honestly. Like, he's just that guy.
So, by auditioning or whatever, trying out for Madden, you're kind of a modern-day George Plimpton, is that what you're saying?
That's an extremely kind thing to say, and yes, I will absolutely take that. But, like, no, when I was doing that, like, my editor was like, you should read some George Plimpton, and I did, and I was like, okay, this is a very good idea, like, this is a good prep on how to do this kind of thing, you know? I absolutely studied a bunch of him before I wrote that story, and, like, I was clearly going for, oh, he cameoed in Good Will Hunting as a psychologist.
Oh, okay.
I feel like he was in a Rodney Dangerfield movie, but I do not remember the name of it, and might be wrong on that, because I know, like, how, like, Kurt Vonnegut appeared in one of the, like, he's that kind of guy where, like, if he popped into a movie in the 80s or 90s, you'd be like, oh, shit, is that George Plimpton? Like, I like that.
So he's apparently got 34 acting credits.
He was just, like, rich and did stuff and, like, started a magazine, and I have a ton of, there's a great Jonathan Coulton song about him that makes me cry. It's a very, very
song?
Cool thing. It's A Talk with George.
Oh, I don't know that one. I know, I feel like I know a lot of Jonathan Coulton, and I look at how much work he's put out there, like, oh, I don't know a lot of anything, because it's like, he's got so many songs, but I know, I gotta listen to that one.
It's from, like, Thing of Weekdays, I believe, so, like, way back
Oh, then. Okay, Yeah, okay. So I've probably heard it at one point, but I don't know it. He will be back. George Plimpton will be on our other Tom show, Mike. He'll be in The Bonfire of the Vanities as Well-Wisher. So I've done probably a small part. This movie opened in second place at the box office behind a little movie you guys might have heard of, Back to the Future.
Oh.
In its seventh week at the box office, still was number one.
Wow, that movie takes place in the 55, and this is in 62. What was going on with period piece comedies back in 85?
I feel like it's just all the time, right? Like, there's how many, you know, 90s TV shows and stuff now, and 90s movies. Like, it's just, we're always hungry for whatever was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. $10 million budget, made just about 20 domestic, so you figure marketing are probably just about broke even. But like we said, the important thing, Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson fell in love and volunteers... is a footnote. It's like, it's probably, it's honestly maybe been a Jeopardy question. I'm actually going to check the J archive right now. Mike, is there anything else about volunteers you want to talk about before we play our games?
It was good to see Hanks and Candy again. It was too bad they don't go on to make, like, a lot of movies together. Like, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, David Spade and, you know, Chris Farley. Like, I feel like Hanks and Candy could have become, like, a marketable comedy duo at some point in the 80s, but I guess, you know, no one was really thinking about that at the time. But I like them here together. I love that him and Rita fell in love while making this movie. It's Volunteers. Like, it's just another, like, one of those early Hanks comedies that isn't as good as I remember when I watched it as a kid, which is just, like, a disappointment, you know? And, like, I wasn't necessarily expecting to love it the way I used to or anything, but I was certainly expecting to like it more than I did. We just got to get to some better material soon. I'm really glad that we're also offsetting this with the Tom Cruise stuff, because his shit has been amazing.
I know. This movie shot in Thailand, it shot in Venezuela, and it shot at Yale, New Haven. So this is back in days where, like, you didn't double a Hollywood backlot or Canada for everything. You actually went to Thailand, and you went to Venezuela, and you went to New Haven, Connecticut. And actually, before we get to your final thoughts, Walt, before we go to the games, volunteers has been mentioned, at least, so I searched Rita Wilson on J-Archive. So she's been six clues in the history of Jeopardy, and volunteers has been named in three of those.
Whoa.
So in 1988, for $500 in the people category, in 1988, this big star married Rita Wilson, his co-star, in the 1985 film Volunteers. And then in 2002, I Married a Star, $200. Rita Wilson worked with him filming Volunteers in 1985, and volunteered to marry him 3 years later.
What?
And then in 2014, in Celebrity Marriages for $600, he met Rita Wilson on the set of Bosom Buddies. The pair reconnected, making the 1985 movie Volunteers. And then there's a couple more, but it's basically all about who is Tom Hanks. He met Rita Wilson on the set of this movie. So it's cool. Like, that's... I love the J Archive. Shout out James Holzhauer. This episode comes out in a week and a half, but I have no doubt that he will still be steamrolling poor chumps across America.
Wild. Michael, who hosts Not Her Again, the podcast that I believe you guys might have tried to recruit for a future podcast.
He will be on future episodes, absolutely.
Yeah, I heard that he mentioned something about the Fast and the Furious ones, and I was just like, oh, that's a choice. Like,
oh, yeah, I met, just side note before we get into the Michael story, is that I messaged him. I was like, hey, you know, Walt did our Too Fast, Too Forever podcast. Do you want to do this?
Yeah.
He's like, I've never seen even a clip from these movies.
No,
he's
never.
Like, if you don't mind an amateur, I was like, cool, watch the first one. We'll let you know what you think. So we're going to find out. Lap 4, Episode 1, Michael Domenico. Lap 4, Episode 1, The Fast and Furious, finding out what somebody who's never seen any of the movies thinks about The Fast and Furious. Okay, so you were saying about Michael.
Yes, so he's a big fan of Jeopardy, and he's just like, I don't always watch it, but just like, this guy's just been like blowing a hole through Jeopardy. It's fascinating to watch. I've just been reading, because there have been a lot of really good stories, because like Ken Jennings is obviously picking up the phone and talking a little bit of the goss, right?
Yep.
And like, I've just loved whenever like people who are really into Jeopardy are just like, finally somebody pulled this off. Nobody ever did this before. Like, it's just great. Like,
he's
going to be a fixture for ages. Or he's going to completely bottom out by betting too much three times in a row.
I thought a lot about this, and Mike, you can cut out as much of this as you as little
no,
as you
man.
Want.
I mean, I had a whole when he started his streak, I had a whole theory about how like he owed money to the mob and they pulled strings to get him on the show, and they're betting on him in Vegas left and right. Like, my mind went on a dream.
that would be awesome. That's the movie that I want to see. Like, I want the Theranos story about that story, Mike. I want to see the podcast about that. I want to see the documentary. I want to see the feature film adaptation. I want to see the Hulu series all about James Holzhauer and the puppet strings behind the scenes. Oh, man.
But he's a tour de force. Because he's good at, like, it's tough to have somebody who's, like, that willing to roll the bones on, like, a weird strategy on Jeopardy and also, like, has the chops to back it up. So it's very cool to watch.
Like, he's only going to lose when he gets a Double Jeopardy wrong and then gets a Final Jeopardy wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think people are going to know more than he does. And if they do, mazel tov, you beat the best.
He's batting 97%. The thing is, like, if he's got, like, that means to get all three wrong, assuming that's the same the whole time, like, there's probably, like, a 10% chance of that. Like the odds that you get all three right every time are, like, 90% if you're batting 97%. I don't know. I'm fascinated by it.
It's incredible. So, Walt, what about you? Any final thoughts about Volunteers before we ask some really goofy questions about this movie?
Any final thoughts about Volunteers? I would not recommend people go out and watch this if they get a chance. I'd recommend perhaps they watch some clips of it, but, like, I don't know if necessarily this is a movie that you need to throw a couple dollars at YouTube for. But in general, like, I think it's wild. I think, like, it's like got some deeply funny moments in it. It's got some stuff that does not even remotely hold up, but 80s Hollywood for you. But again, like, the neoliberal subreddit wrote this movie, and I cannot be persuaded of that fact.
I love that reading of it now. Like, that's so great, because then you go, if, I mean, not that anyone should go watch this again, but if you were to, you can trace how he's just doing everything for himself, but for his own advantage.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, he's just like, go to another country, make a bunch of money, hang out, everybody's better off in the end. It's just like, it's wild. I love it.
Very cool. So now, I want to break your brain a little bit. You probably know what's coming, because we play this on Risky Business. If Tom Cruise were in the leading role here in Volunteers, what would this movie look like? I'll let you go first, Walt, if you have an idea.
Interesting question. I think, so at the time that this movie was released, I think that Tom Cruise is a considerably larger star than Tom Hanks. Is that about right?
Yeah, he's coming off of, like, a Scorsese film. He's doing Color of Money.
Yeah.
Top Gun.
So, metagame, this would destroy Tom Cruise's career. at that point, like, the idea is, like, if he had backed up Top Gun with this picture, we would not have Tom Cruise anymore. But how would the movie be different? Well, honestly, like, this question is fucking with the time stream for me, because, like, what if Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson never got to get, like, I don't, yeah, no, I think this movie, he kind of does something similar to this later in life with American Maid. So, like, he's done the flick where he's an amoral asshole who does illegal stuff in order to gain personal things in developing countries. And so, like, I think that, like, he's got it in him. He'll kind of hit it later, but I really do think that this would have, A, messed with the time stream so much that I don't care to think about it too hard, and B, would have absolutely destroyed Tom Cruise's career.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think, you know, last Cruise Club, Mike, we had Greg McLennan on, and he was saying about how Tom Cruise basically decided, I'm only going to make great movies now. Like, I feel like he just wouldn't have accepted this. And I also feel like it's another one of these movies where I don't know, I think it's hard to judge in retrospect, like, how much of the movie was made for Tom Hanks to be charming, and how much Tom Hanks being charming is, like, the stand-up part. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if his charm stands out here when it does, because that's, like, the best part of the movie, or because that's what they're like, let's just make a movie where he's out in the jungle. He's not a huge star now, but he's been in enough stuff that people know what he can do, right? And so I think it's hard to figure out in retrospect. Like,
yeah, I think the issue that you're gonna find is that, like, Tom Cruise's movies from this era will age far better than Tom Hanks's, just because inherently comedy doesn't age super well.
If an action movie is a good action movie, it'll hold up forever.
Explosions don't look any different now than they did in 85. And so at the end of the day, it's like, and even then with the practical effects, they probably look even better, honestly.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that in general, it's not going to be super shocking to me that these movies don't age as well as the Cruise ones of this era, just by virtue of the fact that Hanks is still kind of in that comedy zone. Whereas, like, just a short while later, once he starts doing a little bit more action, or at least I don't even know if Apollo 13 is action, but, like, you know what I mean? But, like, I think that his movies start becoming more timeless the further they step away from being kind of 80s comedies.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, I think that we're entering sort of an era where it's not necessarily timeless comedies, and we'll see, because I've only seen these movies once, Mike, or if at all, but, like, The Money Pit and Big and Joe vs. the Volcano, where they're comedies that hold up because I feel like they're kind of weirder or less problematic. I don't know. I've only seen those movies once each, so I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Two out of three of those are, like, more fantasy, right? So that plays into it a little better.
Well, high concept age is decent compared to, like, just inherent, you know, like, a high concept, like, Bruce Almighty, like, I haven't watched that fucker in a while, but, like, that seems to kind of pop out a little better than some of the more contemporary comedies of its day, just by virtue of the fact, like, oh, it's a weird concept, like, Liar Liar, like, those movies, like, oh, it's a vaguely fantasy concept in a decent, like, Big age is great. Because Big is, all the comedy of Big is like, oh, it's like very specific, it's of or related to its concept. It's not like punching down at another race.
Yeah, it reminds me why in the 80s there were so many of those body swap comedies, right? Like those, like either a son and father would switch minds or a mom and a Freaky Friday, right? Like it kicked off so many clones. And Big is a quasi sort of Freaky Friday thing. He doesn't switch bodies with anyone, but he becomes older.
It also led to one of my favorite comedy Bang Bang phrases, reverse Big situation.
which is in theaters now, that movie Little.
Yeah, Little is a reverse Big situation. Mike, what about you? What if Tom Cruise was in this movie? How would this play out?
All I could think of was what if Vince from Risky Business, like, finally met his match and, like, owed, like, a million or something, and you know, we're talking like 1987 or 6 or something. The only thing he could do is, like, jump on a plane, join the Peace Corps, and fly halfway across the world to some jungle where he builds a bridge and just, like, teaches everyone how to play pool and, like, wins over the local warlord by teaching them, like, trick shots, and, you know, everything just becomes a big sort of party a la Risky Business.
I like it. I think if we're doing Cruise, I just think that, like, when you're putting him in the middle of the jungle with the CIA around him, I don't see how he doesn't go Taps level intense. And I think that this movie ends in a horrifically different situation where instead of, like, he probably stays over there, but he becomes part of, like, he sort of has like a Vietnam style like mental dissociation from his world, the world around him.
Oh, almost like an Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens. Like, we sort of get to the point where, like, he can still be, you know, still the intro, and he, you know, graduates and whatever, and is on the run and gets over there, and then something just kind of breaks in his brain and he falls in with the wrong crowd or whatever. Like, I think the last half or, you know, third or whatever of this movie is wildly different, and not at all a comedy, but that's sort of that's kind of the vibe that Tom Cruise is giving in these movies.
Are you suggesting that he becomes the Walter Kurtz of the Peace Corps?
Yeah. Like...
Oh, I was thinking he was just like getting drunk and punching mirrors, like dancing in his bedroom.
Oh, I thought that it would be the Brando of it.
No, but that works too. No, yeah.
Yeah.
All of them. All of those things happening. So now, Walt, next question. If you go back in time, before you and I were born, we are now on the set of Volunteers. We want to walk on roll into Volunteers. How would you Stan Lee yourself into this movie? Where would you put yourself? In what scene, walk on roll, small part, bit part, where are you in Volunteers?
I would be on the plane.
Okay.
I would be like the flight attendant. Again, like, all these goddamn hippies going out wet. Like, I would definitely, like, that scene, like, seems like a particular type of hell that I would enjoy being a part of, where they're all just, like, singing Kumbaya shit up there. No, they're singing Puff the Magic Dragon.
They are singing Puff the Magic Dragon,
that's
yeah.
A choice. But I don't know, like, I can't think of too many things that are, like, gambling, but beyond that, this seems like a weird movie to self-insert into.
I would put myself, I think, into the commencement scene somewhere, like just like a graduate who's next to Tom Hanks or something. Or I think, so we hear Tom Cruise, and this is also very nitpicky, but it's also, it's on IMDb, it's incorrect, but I also want to point out that in what world is an NBA Finals game happening where it's so bright out at Yale on the East Coast that you can listen to it presumably in the morning? And none of that tracks. None of that adds up. But I would sort of put myself in as he's listening to, you know, his $14,000 bet. He loses that, and then he gets his diploma and goes down the stairs, and he's so depressed because his life is over because he owes this guy $28,000. I want to be the guy behind him and, like, overjoyed that I graduated from Yale, and just like just contrasting with Tom Hanks, you know, dour disposition. Now, Mike, I know who you have to be, Mike. It's obvious. Do you know the answer?
No, wait, what? Who am I?
So John, the CIA guy, his knife is named Mike. I think
I'm
you have to be
it.
The knife.
I'm the knife.
You're
Mike,
the knife.
The knife. I love it. Yes, absolutely. Because I was actually struggling trying to think of a role to play here, but yeah.
It's just a knife with your face on it.
I love it. Yeah.
Because it's weird when people name inanimate objects, but then for it to be named Mike, it's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
Wouldn't the joke be Mac? Like, it's Mac the knife, right? Isn't it? I don't know.
I don't know, man. That guy's clearly not right in the head, so who knows? We have an email address here on the show, hanks@cageclub.me, if you want to let us know that you're listening, let us know what your favorite Hanks movies are. You can also check out our Patreon page and our Thread the Shop all over at cageclub.me. Now, the last question before we get into the awards, and I think the answer is no, and I think Walt's explanation before of why he likes this movie is the reason why no, but I'll ask both of you now. Does Tom Hanks do anything in this movie that sets him on the path to becoming America's dad?
No.
Well, it's not in the movie, but he does meet his wife, and he
True.
Will, and he,
Ooh.
And, I mean, I guess he already is a father in real life, but I mean, you know, he'll go on to, you know, be a father again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's kind of a cheat, but in this movie, no, not his character.
Walt, do you agree or do you disagree?
That's a brilliant idea, and I like it. And like, because there's literally nothing in this movie that makes Lawrence America's dad.
No.
But like, I think that he's got to be, like, this is a pretty formative component of it, right? You know, like, you know, actually, let's actually walk this back. I don't necessarily think that this is the movie that makes Tom Hanks America's dad. I do think it's the movie, well, at the very least, it's the movie that makes, you know, Rita Wilson Colin Hanks' stepmom, so.
Oh, okay. Okay, yes. So I'm going to say no or not on screen. Okay. Very cool. So let's go to the awards, whatever they're going to be called. Maybe the Golden Volleyballs. I think it might be just the Golden Lassos is kind of cool.
Guys,
like the
why not
the Woody,
why not the Woody?
The Woody, the Woodies. We can just call
oh,
the Woodies.
Yeah, they should
yeah.
just be the
and the Woody
dog.
Goes too. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that's a great call, Walt.
All right. I was overthinking. I was just thinking the Golden Lassos, but I just had to think bigger. All right. Best film, worst film, I'm going to say neither. I think it's sort of, it's closer down the middle. Like, it's maybe closer to bad than good. Best or worst role, again?
Nope.
I like it. I wish maybe he was in a different movie, this character.
So what I'm going to say is the next category is most wasted performance.
I mean, not even that, I'd say. It's not that it's even wasted. I guess I just want to see this character again in a different movie.
Again, this is a very, like, SNL-style movie. Like, even the CIA guy feels like the Bill Hader, like, Grenada guy. I don't even know any. Like, it's not really a well, like, thought-out role or movie, so I don't know if it really, any of those pop out to me, you know?
Best ensemble, I'm going to say... It's not an ensemble on the level of Bosom Buddies, but there's a lot of cool background characters. Like, I like, as racist as it is, I like the kid who plays Long Duk Dong. I like his role in this movie. I like John Candy, but I don't know if I want to nominate this for Best Ensemble, knowing that we're probably going to nominate stuff like Apollo 13 and Toy Story and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Best Fight?
What fight? Yeah.
No, nothing. I mean, so far, nothing's going to beat that fight in Bachelor Party. Unfortunately, it's in Bachelor Party, but I mean, that fight at the end of that movie is great.
Is there a dance scene or a party scene?
There's the bar scene, like where he doesn't. Do they dance after he gives her the coke?
Yeah, not memorable enough to nominate, though, I suppose.
Yeah. Best outfit or wardrobe for him? I'm gonna say no.
You know, like his dinner jacket.
Nah.
She's like, I love your tuxedo. Actually, it's just a dinner jacket.
He does not die, so there's nothing best death. Best line or best freak out? The poll quote for this is just, I like when he wakes up in his first morning there, steps out of his hut, falls in the big puddle, and just says, oh, right, Thailand. But I don't think that's, like, you know, supremely memorable. I just enjoyed it within the scope of the scene. But is there a line or a freak out here?
Does IMDb, like, even list any lines that pop out here?
No.
Doesn't seem like it spawned any catchphrases.
Best soundtrack or theme? No. Okay, now here's an important thing. Best love story, worst love story. Do you want to nominate him and Rita Wilson because it's a love story that transcended the movie?
That's a good argument.
I do, when you put it that way.
Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson.
Yeah, I think that works. You're not going to, like, run out of best love stories, but he's also not, like, a huge romantic lead after a certain point. Like, there's a point where Tom Hanks no longer is a sexual organism, and at a certain point there, like, you're going to kind of run out of opportunities to do best love story, besides, like, him and Catherine Graham, comma, his boss. Like, so it's smart to kind of bank a few of these early on.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Most badass role, no. And then the only other thing we have is best non-Hanks actor, male or female. Do you want to nominate either Rita Wilson or John Candy or someone else in this movie for their performance?
Did we nominate John Candy for Splash?
No, we only nominated. So the only people we have so far is Peter Scolari as Henry in Bosom Buddies and Daryl Hannah as Madison in Splash.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's not a great lineup so far. So, like, is this one of those situations where, like, once you get five, you'll start, like, dropping a few out and adding new ones in?
Yeah, I think so, because we sort of nominate a bunch and then sort of cull it down at the end, too.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's no Buzz Lightyear, but, I mean...
Right. We'll throw John Candy in Volunteers. That's fine. And we can always come back to it. So, yeah, so Volunteers, two things. Best love story and best non-Hanks actor male. We did it, guys. We talked about Volunteers. Any other last thoughts about this movie that I will probably never see again?
Nope.
This was my last remaining experience with a movie.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing it into my life. I really appreciate it. Like, I like being exposed to these weird things that occurred to Tom Hanks. So.
Of course. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this side of the Tom Tom Club. You will be back for big in about 3 or 4 movies. So we're excited to have you back there 5 movies from now.
Oh, my God.
So a little bit of a better, I think, Hanks movie, but we'll see. But why don't you let people know about Numlock News, which is, the only newsletter, aside from the one that my boss writes, that I subscribe to.
Yeah, and thank you for reading. So Numlock is a daily morning brief. It will make you smile on your commute. It will, I know that a lot of news out there, for one reason or another, is an unending hellscape, and I strive to cover stories that are not being covered as much and are very interesting and cool. And so you can find that at, like, on the key on the keyboard, like numlock.substack.com, or you can just go to numlock.news. It's a fun one. Give it a shot, and I'm having a good time with it. And again, it's always a pleasure to be on here with you guys. And I may as well plug, because we're doing a bunch of the recording now, but the Not Her Again, which again is Michael Domenico's operation, is launching its newest miniseries sometime soon. We've done Meryl Streep, we've done Julia Roberts, and now he decided to take the plunge and do the one and only Katharine Hepburn. So it's a bit of a kind of a back in time one.
Wow, okay.
So, like, it's, again, we're in the middle of the recording. I do not know when it's actually going to come out, but it's absolutely potentially of interest. Again, like, Tom Cruise, Tom Hanks, Katharine Hepburn, they all just in the same sentence roll over. But, yeah, I would say give that a shot if you like movies and podcasts and enjoyed me on this one.
I'm also wondering when he's going to take the real plunge and do the actress whose Twitter name he has taken. You know what I mean? Like, when will he become Cate Blanchett is the question.
Great question. He is Cate Blanchett. He might do that. So one reason, again, that I'm sure that there's going to be a bonus episode in this season where he takes a look at Cate Blanchett playing Katharine Hepburn, which is just like right down the middle in The Aviator. Yeah. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. If one of you guys is interested, by all means, reach out. I think that he's trying to look for guests for a few of the episodes to come, but it'll be a lot of fun. So yeah, Cate Blanchett, I would love to do that. She's great.
Mike, is that The Aviator starring serious actor turned comedic actor turned serious actor again, Adam Scott?
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yes, it is. By all means.
He is in that movie. Well, for all things Hanks for the Memories and Cruise Club and everything else that we've got here going on the network, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, and at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Check out our Patreon and Threadless links at cageclub.me. And so next week is Cocktail on Cruise Club, but come back in 2 weeks for the Money Pit here on Hanks for the Memories. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Walt Hickey of Numlock News, and we'll see you in 2 weeks for the Money Pit right here on Hanks for the Memories.
Oh, yes. Thailand.